This is Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast on 88.1 WYPR. I'm Nathan Sterner. When our show's senior producer, Matt Purdy, handed me a copy of the book Limber by Towson University Assistant Professor Angela Pelster, he told me, this is a book about trees. And that description is true, but only to a point. The essays in this book do tell the stories of specific trees, from the tree that owned itself in Georgia to the loneliest tree on Earth, which once stood in the middle of the Sahara. But the trees are often just a starting point for essays that delve into topics ranging from faith to love to language itself. When I spoke with Angela Pelster in July, we began by talking about one of the trees she wrote about, the loneliest tree on Earth, the tree of Teneri. She told us its story.
Well, it was a tree that grew in Niger in the desert, at the edge of the desert. And, you know, it's hard to date it exactly, but it had been growing for hundreds of years. And it took on a special significance, spiritual significance to the people of the area who used to take their salt caravans past it, the Tuareg people, and they would stop and pray at the tree before they would begin their journey.
It was the only tree for like 250 miles around.
Yeah.
It was on maps as the tree. You go through the tree.
Yeah. It's really amazing. As my research said that it was one of the only trees, if not the only tree, that it was on a map. And so it was a really significant tree, and eventually, of course, in the way that these strange things happen, a drunk driver eventually ran into it one night and knocked it over, and that was the end of the tree, and it ended up being picked up and put in a museum instead.
But that was the end of the tree itself. There's something about the symbolic power of the tree, because when the tree disappeared, or rather went to a museum so people could look at it, another tree came up to take the place of the tree that had been there for such a long time.
Yeah, an anonymous person came with a bunch of, I think mostly automotive parts, and constructed a metallic tree that he put in place of it to mark where the tree used to be.
And people still go there to mark where this tree used to be.
Yeah.
The power of the tree is symbol as some sort of religious thing, perhaps.
I think the way things have been lost in that area, the desert is just, it's its own creature. It keeps taking over more and more of the land. And the rest of the story talks about how, you know, there have been times on the planet when that area, something kind of tilted, and it was a really lush area where all sorts of animals and people lived.
The Sahara wasn't always a desert.
So in my mind, it sort of marks the way that things are constantly changing, and the way we try to hold on to the things that were there, mark them, but also the way we try to adapt to it as well.
And that is one of the many trees in this book, Limber. But the book, as I said, is not just about trees. It's about a lot of other things. And I think a good connection to what you said about how things are constantly changing and twisting is how within the essays themselves, the facts change and twist and correct themselves. At one point, you write that the artist Vermeer had 14 children. 2 pages on, you say, no way, he had 15. Were you planning on digressing that way when you started, or did the correct information come in as you were writing?
Well, the whole essay, what I was trying to do was show the process of trying to make meaning and how we make meaning by collecting facts, but also by adapting to things we learn. And that was actually just a really lucky stroke. My editor did an amazing job of fact-checking things for me, because no matter how hard you try, you always miss something. And there were multiple versions of how many children Vermeer had. And when she told me that he had a different number of children than I had initially written, at first I changed it. And I thought, no, this is exactly what this essay and actually this entire book is about, is like trying to assimilate, trying to like absorb the different things that happen and how we make meaning of that. So that one was a luck.
Another
thing,
one on that topic. Your essay Temple, you spend the first several pages on a sexual metaphor with figs, supposedly planted by the Apostle Paul on Cyprus. And then the essay shifts when someone tells you he didn't plant figs, those were olives.
Yeah.
And the essay completely changes in tone, but goes on.
Yeah, that essay drove me crazy. I rewrote it from top to bottom at least 4 times after that shift, trying to make sense of that. And that really like is me on the page trying to understand what this means, because I was so excited when I found that metaphor, and I was like, this is what I have been looking for.
And it's a beautiful metaphor.
Yeah, I know. I was so upset. But to me, the whole idea of an essay is that you're trying to think through something, and you're trying to keep it real and present while you're writing. And so I just rewrote it and rewrote it and rewrote it. And this is what it ended up with. Yeah.
There's another point, a piece that's in part about industrial chemical pollution in Russia, where you refer to a fir tree that was found growing inside someone's lung. Mm-hmm. There's some dispute whether that actually happened. But I found myself, after looking into it myself, did that really happen? Wondering if it really mattered whether or not it happened. And I think that's part of what the essay is about.
Mm-hmm. I'm somebody who doesn't care too much about whether or not something happened exactly. But at the same time, that essay is one that really is a great example to talk about. Because if it hadn't happened at all, I think that essay would have lost a lot of power. Like, what a strange thing that this hunk of tree was found in a man's lung. And if it was growing, that is an incredible thing. And so, you know, it's one of those moments where I have to stop and say there actually is a lot of power in a thing having actually happened. I can't dismiss it completely the way I want to sometimes, but there's also a lot of power in sort of letting the facts be more fluid and existing in places at the edge of fact, maybe. That essay really, you know, actually pulls me in different directions as well. I'm not sure what to think of it either.
There's also a lot of power in words throughout your essays. One in particular, Meditations on a Tree Frog, is about language to some degree. I want you to read from the end of it, picking up just after you've explained that the word frog comes from a word meaning hopper, and another word for frog comes from a word meaning to jump. So let's start right after that.
Sure. Some linguists say that the word man is connected to the meaning to think, and that Latin borrows it from mental, mind, and remember. If a frog is a to jump, and we are a to think, then maybe at the heart of man is a brain, and not a heart at all. We have not named ourselves to love, though we do, and guide our lives by it. Scientists say that at best we can hold on to feeling and love for 7 years. That the 7-year itch is really a matter of chemicals, that a brain can only stay drunk on love for a short period of time until it cries out for rest. Because no matter how we begin, one day you will turn to me and hate my crooked front teeth that you once found endearingly imperfect, and I will look at you and find boring your stories that had once seemed so profound. It is inevitable. But at the center of a word is the thing we have forgotten, and the thing it really is. And that the rival of an exhausted love is the to think itself. A frog jumps, a man thinks, and in thinking is the thing she is. This essay is a love song. In 70 times 7 years, I will not love you at all. Then I will think you until all thinking burns off, until what is left of me is a heart in a maple croaking all night long.
From the essay, Meditations on a Tree Frog, in the book Limber by Angela Pelster, who's joining me here on Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Nathan Sterner. It's a book of essays that share the common theme of trees. There was a pair of sentences that are only slightly connected to the essay there included that really stuck with me, where you wrote, "For 7 years, my last name was not my own, but the one I took from a man I loved once. If I do not love him anymore, is his name and the implication of it still mine?" What did that, because that just sort of seemed like it was placed there as kind of a jewel within the rock of that essay. Mm-hmm. How does that, what meaning does that have to you?
Well, that specific instance was, you know, me working through the idea of what is it to have somebody's name. I was married before. The messiness, the legal messiness that happens now of taking someone's name and changing your name afterwards is a really frustrating process to go through. But I also love the idea that, like, words and names hold some sort of magic. And I think we all actually kind of believe that, or else we wouldn't bother to, like, you know, name our children after ourselves for generations. We wouldn't have all these people trying to seek out their ancestry through following a name. So, you know, I think we sometimes forget how much we, like, buy into this idea of sort of these magical or spiritual connections throughout generations. So that was, yeah, me just trying to work through the idea of what does this mean to have changed my name? What does it mean to have belonged to one group and changed it?
One of the themes that crops up in many of these essays is faith, is your faith in particular. How does your faith affect your outlook on life and your outlook on the way you wrote these essays?
Well, my faith, like everything I'm writing about in the book, is constantly changing. I'm in a very different place now than I was, you know, 5 years ago, even than when I wrote these essays. So it's always interesting going back and thinking of it in terms of that. But, you know, as much as I've, and I have tried in the past to write and really keep my faith out of my writing, but that never works because it's actually very central to who I am. And it's how I understand the world. It's how I translate everything that happens in the world.
And I guess in essays, you're explaining that translation to other people. Mm-hmm. So how can you do it without?
Yeah, yeah. But it's really interesting to try to write in a way that I'm so concerned about trying to be sensitive to the fact that other people don't experience life in the same way I do. And so what I'm really trying to do in these essays is to write in a way that is never trying to explain the world to other people, except that this is me trying to talk about how I understand the world. And so I hope that's what's happening in the essays, is me trying to work through what I believe about the world.
I want to end our conversation with the final essay of your book, and it's a short one, so I'll ask you to read the whole one.
Sure.
It's an essay called Cardinal.
One dark morning after his resurrection, and just before Jesus flew up into heaven, he came to my backyard in the form of a cardinal and balanced on the telephone wire with his skinny black legs. It was early spring, before anything had bloomed, and the grass was gray and mush and rotted. Jesus stood in the sky and whistled the whistle all cardinals do, which sounds something like, "Pretty girl, pretty girl." The sun rose as red as the feathers on his cardinal back and pushed the night off the edge of the world. I saw that it was time for Jesus to return to God, but that he did not want to leave his wire. "Pretty girl, pretty girl, pretty girl," he cried out over the vast and winding earth.
Author Angela Pelster joined me to talk about her book of essays titled Limber back in July. You can learn more about the book online at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Nathan Sterner. Our show continues in a moment. Stay with us.